You're listening to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock.
Big John McCarthy has witnessed the best that the UFC had to offer.
That is it! Game, set, match! We have a new champion!
Your backstage pass to the world of mixed martial arts and combat sports. Only on the Ignotainment Media Network.
Let's get it on!
Hey everyone, welcome to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and me, Sean Wheelock. Every week on this podcast, John and I give you an inside look at MMA and combat sports, always separating fact from fiction. On this week's program, we'll examine New York's continual refusal to legalize professional MMA, which keeps it as the only state in the U.S. to do so. Big John and I will also review the impressive knockout wins this past weekend by Hisaki Kato in Bellator and by Yoel Romero in the UFC and discuss why it matters if a finish is ruled a KO or a TKO. Plus, we'll be speaking to my Bellator MMA broadcast partner Jimmy Smith, who absolutely never holds back. And of course, as we do on every episode of Let's Get It On, John will answer your questions. So ask away via email, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. That's info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Remember that you can download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. For Android, download the Stitcher app and subscribe. And you can go straight to our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. Well, last Thursday, the latest session of the New York State Assembly concluded without a vote on the bill which proposes the legalization of professional MMA in the state. So while amateur MMA remains both legal and unregulated by the State Athletic Commission, professional MMA is still banned in the state of New York under a law enacted in 1997. John, this is absolutely ridiculous. It always has been, continues to be.
You know what? Comedy at its best.
Truly.
Let's be honest. Our political system, especially the one in New York there, is just absolutely pure comedy. That, oh, we just didn't get time to vote on it because God knows that politicians are so fucking busy and so important as far as what they're doing. God knows they wouldn't have time to vote on something. Ridiculous. Totally ridiculous.
So, I mean, the levels of being ridiculous, as you say, just the bureaucracy. It wasn't that it was voted no. It passed the New York State Senate. It then went to the State Assembly. Yeah. Oh, we ran out of time. Sorry about that. Our legislative session ended last Thursday. Couldn't get to it. Darn the luck. This is my biggest problem, though, overall. You either have to be in the pool or out of the pool. You can't dip your toe in. And what I mean by that is in the state of New York, professional boxing, legal. Professional kickboxing, legal. Professional Muay Thai, legal. Professional MMA, illegal. It makes no sense. If you're against combat sports, I disagree with you, but I can respect that philosophy. What I can't agree with and what I certainly can't respect is if you start picking and choosing which combat sports you like and which you don't like.
Well, again, none of this has to do with MMA as a sport. It's all been political. It's all been about unions and, you know, the Fertittas being the owners of the UFC trying to push to get the UFC into the state of New York. Look at the UFC has spent a ton of money going to different states and working towards getting, you know, these states to legalize MMA, to put in, you know, athletic commissions. And, you know, this is money they didn't have to spend, but they're doing it because they're trying to grow the sport, which grows their products. It's called good business. And they've spent more money probably in New York than they've spent in all the other places combined. And the reason why MMA is not legal is because it is the Fertittas trying to get it, you know, in New York. And they are casino owners of non-union casinos. And there is, you know, different unions that are out there trying to put a halt to the UFC coming into New York, which is a huge union-based state. You know, because of the fact that they are non-union people. And so that what does it break down to? It breaks down to it's politics. It's bullshit. Let's just, you know, say what it is. This is ridiculous, you know, ridiculous view of what you're doing, because what you're doing, if you're the unions, is keeping your people from getting work. You're keeping jobs from coming their way. When the UFC or anybody, Bellator, M1, I don't care who, wants to come to New York to put on a show, your people get work. that helps them, that helps the union. So how short-sighted are you in what you're doing? It's ridiculous.
And John, I think if a politician says, well, I don't like MMA, I find it unappealing or too brutal, I think still to serve their constituency, they would have to look at just the economic generators of the UFC, of Bellator, of World Series of Fighting, and then all of the mom and pop shows, which around the U.S. and Canada, those mom and pop shows being held in hotel ballrooms and National Guard armories are probably 98.5% of the live events in our sport. So
you know, Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, John, but I'm saying – so you're losing all of those big and small up and down the scale to Connecticut, to New Jersey, to New Hampshire, to Maine, to Massachusetts. Newark, which is I think about 12, 15 miles, but it's in the state of New Jersey from Midtown Manhattan. Look at the big shows that go to Newark. I love Mohegan Sun. Our great friend Mike Mazzulli is the commissioner there. It's one of the best venues in the world. I don't want to see Mohegan lose anything, but let's be honest. A lot of shows go to Mohegan in Connecticut, which is about a three-hour drive from the city of New York because they can't play in the city of New York. And then you have Albany, you have Buffalo, you have Long Island. You have New York is a big state. We're not just talking about Manhattan.
Here's the problem. I'm going to go off of what you first said because this is the problem. You know, I'm going to just state it the way it is. You know what, Sean? I don't like figure skating. I can't stand figure skating. In fact, it fucking makes me throw up in my mouth. It's so pathetically boring and just ridiculous. And especially, in my opinion, to watch a guy act like a girl out on ice is just, it's repulsive. So no one should be able to watch figure skating because John McCarthy thinks it's repulsive. Now, it doesn't matter what John McCarthy thinks about figure skating. If I don't like it, I don't have to watch it, okay? And when a politician puts his own personal view, because see, what a politician doesn't realize anymore is it's not what he fucking likes. It's what does his constituents like? What do the people that he is supposedly representing, what do they want? I don't care what he wants. I care what the people want. That's what he is supposed to be there for, not about what his own personal view, because his own personal view is that of one person, the same as mine is.
Don't give me
this crap about, I don't like it. No one gives a shit what you like. It's what do the people like? What do they want? Is it something that is bad for them? No. Oh, it's been proven it's not bad for them. So then, you know what? Your job is to represent the people that put you in that seat.
John, I think that's extremely well said because in a democracy, in a republic, you're elected to serve your constituency. And I don't think that that's being done in the state of New York. We've talked about it here on Let's Get It On before, but I know we're gaining new listeners every week. A lot of you didn't hear this earlier discussion. It's been lost to history. Some people know it, some people don't. But a lot of newer fans are unaware that the UFC held an event in New York, which was refereed every bout by Big John McCarthy, UFC 7, Buffalo, New York, September 1995, 2 years before this New York state law was enacted banning a professional MMA.
Absolutely. You know, look, and again, it was everything is politics. It's ridiculous, you know. And first off, I want to say sorry to all the figure skaters out there. I really don't hate you. I just used you.
They're not listening. Don't worry.
Exactly. But, you know, we did. We went to the Odd, which was where the Buffalo Sabres played for UFC 7. They sold that place out. It was packed. It was huge. And, you know, they made a deal. What most people don't realize is New York was one of the first states to legalize MMA. They wrote it into law. It was legal there. Governor Cuomo put it into. He signed his name. And the problem was we have, you know, different organizations and things. And, you know, there was a deal made by the UFC. The owner at the time was Bob Meyerowitz. He made a deal saying that he would not bring the UFC to New York City. He would not bring it to Madison Square Garden until the state of New York and the New York State Athletic Commission were comfortable with the sport. And he said he would bring it to the outlying cities, bringing money there. He'd bring it to Albany. He'd bring it to Niagara. He'd bring it to Buffalo, but he wouldn't come to New York City. But that was a deal that he made by himself with the politicians in power at the time. But there was no other promoter that made that deal. So right away, Extreme Fighting Battlecade said, we're going to Madison Square Garden. And the state of New York went into a tizzy and quickly signed a thing, basically a rules for the sport of mixed martial arts that were basically amateur boxing rules. And quickly tried to write into legislation that it was now illegal and have ridden that ridiculous, you know, bill that would put MMA as being illegal in the state of New York, and have ridden that to the point of the exclusion of every other state and province within North America. They are the only ones that have it as illegal, which only goes to show how intelligent they are. Come on, get a clue.
Every week on Let's Get It On, we bring you our poll question. You can cast your vote on our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. This week's poll question: do you believe that professional MMA will be legalized in the state of New York within the next 5 years? Vote yes or no at letsgetitonpodcast.com. John, you and I are very careful to say professional MMA because I think a lot of fighters, a lot of fans, even a lot of MMA journalists are unaware of the fact that there is a decent amount of MMA in New York right now. Mainly it's at the amateur level, or quote-unquote amateur level, what we saw in the 1990s in a lot of states like Missouri, which is about 12 miles away from where I'm sitting in Shawnee, Kansas. They had quote-unquote AMI MMA, but some guys were getting paid or compensated through ticket sales. It was kind of in a semi-professional gray area. Right now that goes on in New York because of this ban and because the New York State Athletic Commission not getting involved. Also, there is sovereign land. There are Native American tribal casinos in New York that have and continue to host professional MMA. They're not getting the major shows, but they are doing it. So there is MMA in New York. It's just not professional, and it's not professional when it's off of sovereign land, and it's not regulated by the New York State Athletic Commission, which to me is ridiculous. So you have the State Athletic Commission. They're allowing through the backdoor MMA, but they're not being involved. I guess they really don't care about safety then, do they?
That's, you know, really, that's what you're looking at. It's what people don't understand is there is amateur MMA going on all the time in New York, in the state of New York, in the city of New York, everywhere. There is, you know, like you said, sovereign land. The Seneca Nation has MMA all the time. The MMA is taking place in New York. So what's really occurring is the UFC has been trying to do this by walking, how I talk about it. They're trying to walk through the front door. They're trying to do this the right way. They're trying to do this in a way that they're not going behind anyone. They're not pulling any tricks. They're walking through the front door saying, look, we want you to legalize this. We want to use the New York State Athletic Commission. We want you guys to be the regulatory body that, you know, governs this sport and follows it the same way that everyone else is. They're trying to walk through the front door. Now, they can walk through the back door if they want. What people don't realize is the UFC knows that there are stipulations within the regulations of New York where the UFC can go to New York City right now. They can go to New York City. They could go to Madison Square Garden, and they could put on a show because all they need to do is get a sanctioning body to put on that show. It will override the New York State Athletic Commission. And they could put on a show right now, but they're not doing that because, again, they're not trying to do this in a way that is to just say, oh, well, we're going to do it anyways. They're trying to walk through the front door instead of walking through the back door. And you gotta admire them for the way they're trying to handle this in a professional way. But they could take their show there, and there's nothing that could stop it once they had that sanctioning or organizational committee from a sanctioning body backing them and regulating it. They could do it.
And by sanctioning body, we're talking about a sanctioning body from another combat sport or what we see in AMI MMA. So we're talking Absolutely. About ISKA, KICK, SPIRE, those types of organizations.
Exactly.
John, final point. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm saying if all you need is one of them, and there are ones that can, they'll do it. They'll do it for them right now. But this all comes down to this, you know, the organization trying to do something the right way, not trying to backdoor anybody, not trying to go and end around. And, you know, I think it's gotten to the point for the UFC where they just look at him and go, you're the ones losing out. You're the idiots. I think they're going to stop, you know, putting, you know, any real attempt into trying to get this passed. They're just going to let it run its course. Eventually it's going to pass. They're going to have time to vote on it because God knows, you know, their busy schedule, but eventually it's going to pass and, you know, things are just going to move forward the way they should. It's just ridiculous what's occurred to this point.
John, final point on this. Don't you think this has to be an embarrassment for the New York State Athletic Commission? And they're kind of caught in the middle because they realize there's all of this AMI, quote unquote, AMI, semi-professional MMA going on in their state off of sovereign land. And yet they can't do anything about it. To me, an athletic commission, first and foremost, has got to be about fighter safety, generating revenue and collecting the taxes and dealing with promoters. All of that is secondary. Primarily, it's got to be about protecting the athletes, protecting the combatants.
It's a great point you bring up because, you know, the New York State Athletic Commission is sitting there. There's nothing they can do. This is not their fight. This is nothing, you know, to do with them saying, oh, we don't want it. They want it, you know, they want MMA there. It's just, you know, the politics that surround, you know, the, you know, that state, you know, there's heavy politics and there's nothing that the athletic commission can do. And they know what's going on. They know all the amateur fights that are going on. They know about the professional fights going on. And right now they're stuck in a position where there's really nothing they can do. And it's not their fault. It is the politicians that run the state.
Well, last Friday night, Hisaki Kato recorded a legitimate candidate for knockout of the year when he finished Joe Schilling with a left-handed Superman punch in the second round.
Did he not?
Oh, did he ever? And I got to commentate the fight, which was a thrill. I think it's going to be knockout of the year. And then the next night, of course, in the UFC, Yoel Romero KO'd Lyoto Machida in the third round with a series of devastating elbows. John, you refereed that fight. So what we have are two brutal and incredibly impressive finishes, both recorded as a knockout, although the ending sequences, John, were markedly different.
Yeah, they were different, but it's hard to explain to people what, you know, knockouts are in MMA because they're different than it is in boxing to a point. But, you know, you look at the knockout that Kato had against Schilling. Man, you know, that Superman punch was impressive because Schilling was out going down. Then he gets, you know, as he's going down, his head hits the canvas. Sometimes that'll kind of bring guys back. It definitely didn't. It kind of just made it worse. And Kato even came in with another blow as Rob Hines is, you know, running, trying to get to him because, you know, it sometimes as a referee, we're out of position just based upon we're moving and all of a sudden something happens in a direction that goes away from us. And that's exactly what happened there. And so Rob got there as quick as he could. He did a great job. But that knockout is so impressive in the fact of who was knocked out. Joe Schilling is, you know, when you talk about a stand-up fight, that's a bad dude. That's a dude that can fight. I mean, I've done kickboxing shows with Joe as, you know, one of the competitors where I've reffed it. That man can fight the stand-up game. He is tough. He's durable. And, you know, he's been working at trying to get into MMA. And the grounds is real big, you know, weakness right now, and you're looking at, you know, what happened in the fight. If you watch the first round, he got taken down by Kato, and he ends up, you know, he's talking to him, he's calling him all kinds of names, and he's saying nasty things to him. And in the second round, it's just the mere fact that he needs to protect his legs from the takedown that sometimes his hands go down. And that's what happened with the, you know, what Kato did is he caught him in that mid-range where he's coming forward quick, and Joe is starting to think about defending a takedown, and he gets hit with that Superman punch. It was beautiful. Knocked out completely. He was out for a while. Obviously, anyone's going to call that a knockout. What happened with Machida and Yoel Romero was he got knocked out completely also. He got brought back, but he got knocked out with two incredibly hard elbows, both of them in the center of his face on his nose. The first one broke his nose. The second one, you know, they didn't show Lyoto's face, but Lyoto was a mess. His nose was pushed down into his sinus cavity. It was as bad a break as I think I've ever seen. And you know, knocked out, that's a knockout. What we really have are questions about the difference between what is a TKO and what is a knockout.
And why is it important? Because I think a lot of fighters even don't understand the importance of, as the referee, it's your responsibility to tell the presiding commissioner, sanctioning body, what this is, a knockout or a TKO. And as a commentator, I'm really clear on it, John, because it's not just a matter of semantics. It really matters how it's recorded.
It does. And the reason it matters, we're talking about the health and safety of the fighter. That's what we're looking for. And it also goes, there's multiple levels of why it's important that you give them the right call. And we've used TKO in MMA way too much. And we get people that think that if the fighter does not go unconscious, then it's a TKO. That's not true. What we go by is we want to have a system of understanding. We need to protect the fighter who has received traumatic injury to the brain. Now, when we talk about traumatic injury, there's different levels to it. But anytime you get, you know, knocked silly, you have had an injury to the brain. Sometimes you get concussed, where it's a more dramatic injury to the brain. Sometimes you get, you know, knocked out completely, and it's an even more dramatic injury to the brain. But we're always working with trying to protect the fighter in giving them time away from the sport if we believe that their brain has been traumatized in some fashion during that contest. So what we'll do is we try to go off of, you know, the simple thing that I came up with, you know, long ago before UFC 3 was, you know, we were going to stop the fight if the fighter could not intelligently defend himself. And so the question that the referee needs to be asking themselves, is the fighter able to defend himself? So if the fighter is able to defend themselves but they're not fighting back, then we're going to call it a TKO if we stop that fight, because they can defend themselves. They're just not doing it because they become overwhelmed, meaning that their brain is still working. It's when the fighter cannot intelligently defend himself because he has been damaged to the point where his brain is not working in the normal capacity that it normally functions at. Now we're going to call it a KO, even if they did not go completely unconscious. If you go to boxing, you know, you and I are boxing, Sean, and I hit you with a left hook to the liver and you go down and the referee starts counting and he gets to 10 and you don't get up, what's it called?
Straight knockout.
It's called a knockout. Now, your brain wasn't affected at all, but it's still a knockout. And this is what people need to understand. We don't always go by the loss of consciousness to make the call that this is a KO. The KO is important because it allows the ringside physician to give mandatories when it comes to suspensions. Those suspensions help the fighter in recovering from what has occurred and keeps them safer, so they're not getting back into the gym or back into a fight where they can become more severely damaged based upon a lack of time between what has occurred. And that's the question that some people are looking at with Lyoto. Lyoto had a very hard fight against Rockhold. He lost that. He came back quickly. Now, you know that he had to come back and be in the gym working out and sparring to get himself ready for Yoel Romero. So a lot of people are looking at it saying, I think he came back too quick. And you know what? They might be right with that.
John, you and I know that a lot of referees in the U.S., Canada, and worldwide listen to our podcast every week. And because the onus of responsibility is on the referee to report the result to the presiding commission or sanctioning body, you have to put a lot of thought into that, because we're talking about suspensions. We're talking about when a fighter can next fight, when he can next train. It's a very important situation. It's not just, TKO, KO, what's the difference? And unfortunately, as our sport has evolved, I think a lot, as I say, a lot of fighters, a lot of fans, a lot of broadcasters, media people mix it up. I was looking online at an article, and they were talking about Romero's TKO win over Machida. It was clearly announced by Bruce Buffer, KO. You clearly said it to the Florida Commission. But again, these are journalists, and they're mixing up the terms. They're mixing it up not out of laziness, but I think they don't understand the difference. They don't understand the importance of why there should be a difference.
Exactly. And again, When the fighter is not intelligently defending themselves, it's a TKO. When the fighter cannot, it is a KO, and it needs to be put there because that, again, that's for that safety of that fighter. It's also for the record, it helps with commissions. So the commissions can look at a fighter and say, how was this person beat? Well, when they see KO, they know his brain was scrambled. So if they see multiple KOs in a row, they're saying, oh, this guy's got a problem. And it starts to either lead them into the realm of, we're not going to allow this fight, or we want extra medical studies done to make sure that this person is okay. And all of that is for the safety of that fighter, so they don't go into another fight in a position where they have not been checked out as, you know, completely as they should be. And, you know, all of this is stuff that we need people to understand. This is not, we're trying to, oh, he wasn't out, you're saying it's a KO, you're trying to make him look bad. It's the most, that's the most ridiculous thing. And I've heard it from, you know, from people. It's like, I've heard fighters, I wasn't completely out. You didn't know what your middle name was for a certain point in that fight. Okay. That's what we're looking for. You need to understand we are here to help the fighters with their safety. And sometimes, you know, the fighters are the worst ones at that. They don't care about it because they don't look at the future. They don't look at what is going to be. You've got to do it for them.
Of course, every week here on Let's Get It On, Big John and I answer your questions. Ask away via email, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. And as the commentator who last week on the Bellator prelims called the Brianna Fissori versus Yoni Razafiorison fight, you know that saying names correctly truly matters to me. So
say
please,
that three times fast. What? Say that.
I said it
fast.
About 80 times fast in their three-round fight. Please include a pronunciation guide for your name. First up, Eric McGracken, who did send a pronunciation guide. Thank you very much, Eric. Really good question. Listen to this, John. So Eric writes, given that the majority of combat sports deaths occur at lower weight classes with dehydration likely playing a role, and given that rapid extreme weight cuts have become an accepted norm in MMA, and further given that the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency's stance on IV dehydration, what is the solution to address the real concern that a dehydrated athlete will die from brain trauma in MMA?
Wow, what a question, man. You got it. You understand it. It is the problem. The real problem and why USADA does not allow the use of an intravenous IV to hydrate is many athletes will take stuff and use that to flush their system and try to basically hide something they've taken. So that is why they don't want the athletes using the intravenous method for rehydration. It's valid, but we do need to always be looking at what's the best for the fighters. And we, you know, our whole community when it comes to the fighting game has gotten into this, you know, being lighter is better. Being the bigger guy in the smaller weight class, I'm going to be better. And it's so absolutely wrong. You know, and sometimes it's right. You can take a look at a fighter. You know, Lorenz Larkin is a guy that started out here in California, and, you know, and I refereed him in smaller shows, and he was a light heavyweight, and he was a small framed, heavily muscled light heavyweight, and, you know, super fast, faster than everyone by far in the light heavyweights, and just started picking people apart, started, you know, gaining wins, and then ends up going into the big leagues and goes to 185. And he's a small framed 185er. And he starts to have some problems. Now he's at 170 and doing well because he's been able to maintain that speed. His speed now is still, he's super fast, but it's not to the point where he's just overwhelming with speed compared to like he was when he was fighting light heavyweights. But he has carried that speed down with him into the 170-pound class. He doesn't care about being the stronger guy. He cares about being in a weight class that fits his frame. And I understand why Lorenz went to 170 pounds. But you'll find a lot of guys that are trying to be the bigger, stronger guy in the smaller weight class. And the most important thing, I think, you know, when when you're looking at fighters and you're looking what's important, speed kills. Speed is the number one thing. And when you are a bigger guy and you go down into a lighter weight class, there's one thing that you usually do not bring with you, and that is speed. You may be stronger, but being stronger is one element of a fight that is usually the one that is least positive in my view. I want guys that are fast. I want guys with technique. Then I want strength. And so when we look at what's happening with the sport, we get a lot of people that are trying to lose a ridiculous amount of weight to be the big guy in a small weight class. And it has affected them. Some, you know, they'll go into one fight and it works well for them. And they'll go into the next fight and it absolutely works against them. Guys are doing all kinds of things to try to manipulate and figure out what works for them. They're doing very hard workouts the day of the fight. So once they've rehydrated to get their body to get past the shock of having to be active and put out this high frequency effort of, you know, just the push that they're going to have, they're going to do that in a workout before the fight. And what we really need to do is get guys to understand, be in the weight class that's right for you. There's no perfect. You know, we can do a hydrostat test and have it to where fighters are given the same thing as, you know, a high school or a college wrestler or, you know, any of those guys, where you can't be below this weight. You cannot compete below this weight. And, you know, that's great, you know, if they start doing it, but it's not perfect. There's no perfect. What the most important thing is, we need to educate our fighters into understanding that what you do now to your body, you're not going to pay for until years down the road. And I guarantee you're going to pay for it. You're going to pay for all of those dehydration situations. You're going to pay for the things that are occurring, you know, in training and the things that are occurring in that cage. Those are all things that, you know, later on in life, we pay for. You know, at 52 years of age, I'm paying for all the stupidity I did when I was 25 and 35. You know, and you know, you don't think about it back then. It's like, hey, I don't care. You do care when, you know, later on, because we all almost look at it like, ah, you know, 50, God damn, I'll never make it to 50, or that's so old, that's so long, I don't even have to worry about it. Well, trust me, it gets there. And once it's there and you have a hard time getting up, you have a hard time moving, you have a hard time remembering things, you know, it makes a difference. We need to help fighters with the education of what is, you know, good for them, what is bad for them, what they're doing to themselves with some of these weight cuts. I think education is the biggest tool in getting people to start to get an idea of, I can't lose so much weight.
Our next question comes from my daughter, Ellie, who just turned 10 last week. Your favorite 10-year-old, and of course, John, your favorite 4-year-old, my daughter, Hadley, who calls you Big John the Carthy.
The Carthy.
So, like Ellie, Ellie, who has been to, obviously, a lot of weigh-ins with her dad, asked, why don't people boo when a fighter weighs in overweight? They clap when a fighter makes weight. That's my girl, John.
That's a funny question. You know what? I go by, there's three things that are required of a fighter. And, you know, even training for the fight is not required for him. But, you know, a fighter has a responsibility to the promotion. He has a responsibility to the other fighters there. And two of those responsibilities are, be on time. Don't make other people wait for you. Don't make other people have to, you know, put up with being hungry, thirsty, because you are the one holding everything up. Be on time. Second, make weight. That is your job. Your job as a professional is to come in and hit the weight that you're supposed to hit. If you can't hit it, then go to a different weight class. But that's your job. And the last thing that's your job is come in and fight hard. Do your best. I'm not saying you have to come in and win, but fight hard. Give the fans what they paid for, because they paid for you to come in and fight. That's the three things that are your responsibility as a professional fighter. So I agree. I want to boo when they don't make weight because they're not holding up their end of the bargain.
I love seeing that from the eyes of a kid. And Ellie's been training Muay Thai. She's now at the American Top Team gym, I'm proud to say, in Kansas City. She's been training Muay Thai for about a year and a half. But to her, it just made sense. Well, they need to be on weight. So 0.8 over, she wants to go boo. I think that would be a nice deterrent for fighters, wouldn't it?
I don't know. You know, my dad told me long ago, I was a kid. Yeah, my dad used to take me to the Olympic Auditorium for boxing all the time. And he also took me to the L.A. Coliseum. And one time there was a fight. And, you know, I was a young kid. I was probably 7 years old. And, you know, people started booing. And so I, you know, just followed right along. And I boo. And all of a sudden I got smacked upside the head. And my dad looked at me and he goes, "Don't you ever boo." He says, "When you can go down there and do better than that person, then you start booing. Other than that, shut up." I've learned don't boo.
Remember, email us your questions, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Or if you're one of my two daughters, just tell dad and I'll try to get it on. Still to come on this week's episode of Let's Get It On, John and I will be joined by my Bellator MMA broadcast partner, Jimmy Smith, who refreshingly always says what's on his mind, no matter the subject. With Big John McCarthy, I'm Sean Wheelock. You are listening to Let's Get It On. It's the book that Wrestling Observer calls a must-read for any MMA fan. Jonathan Snowden of Bleacher Report describes as riveting and amazing, and thefightnerd.com says nothing is held back. Pick this book up right away. Is This Legal? The inside story of the first UFC from the man who created it, written by UFC founder Art Davey and me, Sean Wheelock, with the foreword by John McCarthy, is now available to listeners of this podcast at the special price of $12.48. That's far less than you'll pay for the book on Amazon and half price of what you'll pay in store at Barnes & Noble. Buy it directly from the publisher now online at ascendbooks.com and enter the promo code LEGAL50. That's ASCENDbooks.com, promo code LEGAL50. Learn the true story of how the UFC came into existence in the book that Randy Couture describes as honest, shocking, and enthralling, and that has a rating of 4.9 out of 5 stars from Amazon Reader Reviews. Is This Legal? The inside story of the first UFC from the man who created it by UFC founder Art Davey and me, Sean Wheelock, with the foreword by Big John McCarthy. Available now online at ascendbooks.com for just $12.48 when you use the promo code LEGAL50. Hey, this is Sean Wheelock.
And this is Big John McCarthy.
If you're a fan of our show, then you're going to love the rest of the Ignotainment podcast lineup.
Like the Ocho Man behind the eight ball and the Whiskey Philosopher with Jeff Cooper.
You can find these great podcasts and more at Ignotainment.com. Thanks again and enjoy the rest of the program.
Let's get it on!
When looking for new and exciting clothing concepts, look no further than Lambs to Lions. Lambs to Lions has great designs that incorporates the past from boxing with the new and exciting evolution of MMA. We all start out as lambs, but with time, training, and hard work, we can all become lions. Be part of the Lambs to Lions movement and check out all of their great designs. You can get your Lambs to Lions gear at the Las Vegas Fight Shop or go to lambstolionsbrand.com.
Now, back to Let's Get It On with your hosts, Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock.
Jimmy Smith is, of course, my Bellator MMA broadcast partner, and he's also one of my closest friends. Earlier, Big John and I spoke to Jimmy, and I began by asking him what he thinks is the biggest difference in MMA from when he made his pro debut in 2003.
The size of guys. The weight cutting ability of guys now is off the chart. I mean, when I fought at 170, I was on the smaller side of 170, but not like freakishly small. Douglas Lima is like 220, 230, seriously. Every competitive welterweight now walks over 200. They walk over at least over 200. And back when I was fighting, guys didn't do it that much. They cut, you know, 10 or 15 pounds. Some wrestlers cut a lot. But I remember watching, Jorge Rivera versus Diego Sanchez at 185. And those were big dudes. And the fact that he got down to 55 is insane. But that, I think that's the biggest disparity. I mean, other than when it was on sanction, everybody doped constantly. But it's, you know, it wasn't.
What do you say?
It wasn't sanctioned, so you could do whatever you wanted. The size of guys has the weight cutting that was the ability of a few guys who had wrestled D1 has gone over the whole spec. Everybody knows how to do it. Every big team knows how to cut the weight. So guys are just massive for their weight classes.
First off, I want to say, dude, it's an honor being able to just sit with. No, I'm telling you, you know what? Look, you know, we've been around each other for a long time in different ways and stuff. And, you know, Jimmy as a color, you know, colorman, when you understand the role of that job and what it entails, the what you do when you are on air with Bellator and the way you break down a fight is beautiful. I just want to tell you that. I love the way you do it. You're outstanding at it. I know Joe gets all the credit and everything. You do a phenomenal job. I'm not taking anything from Joe. He's great. He's super enthusiastic. But the actual technical aspects and the technical knowledge that you put into making people understand what's going on are fantastic.
Thank you, man.
Now I'm going to start asking you questions. Literally. Well, you know, you did fight. You got to do some things. You had Fight Quest as a TV show. You know, how did you get involved with that? How did that come about? And what did you think when you were doing it?
It came about, it's a weird story, and the only person that can answer it is unfortunately deceased. Joe Camacho was a former teammate of mine.
Good friend of mine.
Yeah, great dude. And I don't know how he had heard about this opportunity, but there was a show that people were filming, and they needed fighters for it. And out of the blue, I got a call from a producer in New York saying, we have the show, and we're looking for fighters, and they said somebody mentioned you. I found out later it was Joe Camacho. I didn't know at the time who mentioned me. And we did a phone interview for like an hour. They really liked me. And they said, we're going to be doing an audition at your gym in Manhattan Beach and with a bunch of other fighters. And we'd love to have you come and you know, try out for this. And they gave me an overview of what the show was. They said, you're going to be in different countries doing different martial arts. Well, I have a degree in history from UCLA. That's what I studied. So I went home and I looked up all these different martial arts, and I just studied all the histories of them. I knew a lot already, but there were some I didn't know. And so when they pointed the mic at me, they would have me do things like, all right, pretend you're somewhere in Southeast Asia and we're talking about Muay Thai. I had taken Southeast Asian history, so I took a temple that I had studied and pretended I was standing in front of it and gave the whole history of it and said, now we're going to do a Muay Thai fight. And they went, you're our guy. I had just known. So when they said you're in Russia, I knew the history of the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. I had studied that. So I pretended I was in front of it and just gave a little history lesson about it and then talked about Sambo and how it was originally military style and blah, blah, blah. And that combination was like, we haven't seen anybody else that can do that. You're our guy. The producer at the end of this audition said, as much as I can tell you, you got it, you got it. She's like, I got to go back to New York and show your tape to the network or whatever, but you're our guy. And so that was it, man. It took, you know, one audition in an afternoon, and that was it. I got it.
And Jimmy, from Fight Quest is how you and I became a broadcast team. Jerry Millen, who was my boss at Pride, brought me to M1. He could not find a color commentator. And we're literally a week out from our first M1 show. It was February of 2008. We're about to get on a plane for Amsterdam. And Jerry's scrambling. He says, what about that guy who does Fight Quest? He goes, I think I'm going to try to send him a Facebook message. Yeah. Like, yeah, I think he's really talented. And there we go.
Yeah, he sent me a message. And I got a message. And he had just made the profile to message me. So it was blank. Like, there was no photo on it. It was, like, creepy. Like, there was no photo or anything. It just had his name on it. And it said, I'm Jerry Millen. I was a former VP at Pride. We're doing this thing for M1. Can you do a show in Amsterdam next week? Can you fly out next Wednesday? And I went, yeah, sure. I got a passport. I can do that. And I flew out, and Sean gave me the lesson, which was, this is if you need to cough. This button is if you need to go to the truck. But they don't speak English, so all right, yeah, there we go.
There you go.
And it was a—
You're going to be great.
You're going to be great.
There you go.
And so it was, which was a really interesting thing. We were in Amsterdam, and before our MMA fight started, they had a Slam event, which is a promotion in Holland that does Muay Thai, and it was the top 5 fighters from Thailand versus the top 5 fighters from Holland in Muay Thai. So we ended up calling about 10 Muay Thai fights.
Yeah, Malapet, Sauer.
Andy Sauer, Yaltsin Clive Fairtex. And I had trained with Malapet already, so he knew me. And I knew enough Muay Thai that it was a great warm-up. And so we called these fights, and they've never aired our call of them. They were just kind of a warm-up. So by the time we did our first MMA fight, we had already been calling for about a significant amount, about an hour at least.
Oh, that's significant.
That's a lot of time. Yeah.
You guys really practiced.
I was warmed up. So anyway, so by the time we started our first MMA fight, we had already been calling, so it was much easier that way. But that's how it started. Hey, can you get on a plane next week? Yeah, sure, no problem. And yeah, that was exactly how I started my career.
And Jimmy, I don't even know if you know this, but Millen had said to me going in, we'll give him one show and then see what happens. And really? Afterwards, yeah. Millen says to me, what do you think? And honest to God, I said in five shows, he will be the best color commentator in this sport. And there we are 8 years
Damn.
Later.
I'm amazed at that show of confidence, Sean. But, and then we did M1 for 2 years? Two and a half?
2 years.
Yeah. And then what happened was M1 was – they're still around, but the broadcast that required us, their U.S. deal, was kind of falling apart. And Jerry and a bunch of people who had gone from M1 to Bellator mentioned us. They needed a color commentating team. And a bunch of people who were in production at M1 went over to Bellator and kind of threw our names in the hat. And that was how it worked. We kind of just one started sinking and we went to the other one. And that was our transition.
Yeah, there was like 2 months. We were in St. Petersburg and then we were in Fort Lauderdale. It was kind of just like a weird, seamless transition.
Yeah, yeah. That's how it all happened, man.
All right. The one thing that I love about you is you're such a sexy man. No, that's not.
Dude, that's totally normal. We've hung out a lot. Known you for a long time, John.
Did it all the time.
Known you for a long time.
You know, When you are commentating and you're doing your color and you're talking about what the fighters are doing, they have you score the round. And that is not an easy thing to do.
Hardest part of it is
so hard to do because you've got so many things going on. People don't realize that, you know, there's people talking in your ear while you're talking and there's all kinds of this stuff going on. And then you have to score the round. And I'm being honest, 98% of the time you're spot on. There's always going to be some times where, you know, I may look and say, I think this guy won, and you go this way. But obviously, I'm right. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
just I just
John's
don't know
right.
what
John's right. What do you want? Yeah, exactly. But, I'm not going to argue with a giant. Yeah, go ahead.
You do. You get it. You would be an incredible judge in the sport of MMA, but obviously you're making more money doing what you do in your life.
Right.
But really, you have an incredible gift for understanding fights and picking the right guy in the fight.
It is the hardest part of my job because I put it out there. It's me. And I don't hide from my scorecard. I mean, it's literally public on TV. And so the one thing I never get in life, not just in sports or in scoring, is if a fight's 29-28 one way and you think it's 29-28 the other way, we're both saying it was a comparatively close fight. And people flip the fuck out on me about, you know, Richmond Dantes. I thought Richmond won that last round. He threw more. He landed more. Dantes got a takedown. 6-1, half dozen of another. I thought Richmond did a little more damage, and I went with Richmond. I say on air, close fight could have gone either way. I'm going with Richmond because of this, but it wouldn't surprise me the judge went with Dantes. You're a fucking idiot. Like, the emotion people put behind something. It's not like I saw it 30-27 and everybody else saw it 30-27 the other way. It was obviously a close fight. And the idea that people get so worked up, even when I say, this is close, man. If you like this, it's for this guy. If you like this, it's for that guy. I'm going this way, but could go either way. And people still get all over your case about it because you've made yourself a target by taking a side, in a sense, by writing down that number.
As soon as you say, I'm going this way,
you are making a commitment, and you are a target. And that's the hard part, the hardest part of my job. The second hardest is interviews. That is easily the second hardest part of our job because it's the one time we're not in control. And you know, it's become a big joke that I don't let go of the microphone, but I still hold it long enough for them to start talking, you know, or say whatever. I'll hold the fucking thing. Just you can't take it. And so the thing is that I let the fighter say their piece. And a lot of times a fighter is going off the rails, man. And then there's nothing I'm just holding the fucking thing. And so, and the producer, Robbie, love him to death, is yelling at me like, you know, cut him off, end it. And I go, you know, I'm not pulling the mic away from Hector Lombard. I don't give a shit. He can fucking start reciting Shakespeare, and I'm going to sit here and hold this goddamn thing. You know, so it's that one part, that variable of, you know, the fucking Tito Bonner thing where I'm just holding that mic going, oh, Jesus, this is off the fucking rails. And there's nothing I can do about it. It's just, it's live TV, and you told me to interview the guy, so I'm going to interview him, you know. That's the hardest part of the job.
Well, the microphone story is, so at M1, you never did any in-cage interviews or in-ring interviews. But when we started Bellator, they said, Jimmy, you're going to do that. So my advice to you was, don't let go of the mic, because if they get it, they're thanking every local car dealership and everyone who ever rolled.
They're wandering around the cage or wandering around the ring. What people don't get about that is that nobody's supposed to do that. You know, as an ESPN, they'll interview them. They'll never let the football player hold the microphone because they'll run around and you can't get it back.
It's like the mouthpiece with the referee. I don't ever hand the mouthpiece because as soon as you do, you've lost control.
You've lost control of it. And it's one of those things where you go, Jimmy never lets go of the microphone. No, nobody's supposed to let go of the microphone. It's just people try to take it from me more than people try to take it from other people. It's become some kind of thing. And it's what they don't understand is the interview, not only is it difficult because, you know, I want the fighter to say their piece, it's the most disposable part of the show. If we're running low on time or there's a problem, it's the first thing to go, hey, we're killing the interview. My producer will tell me in my ear, we're killing the interview, we're running low on time. So it's the first thing to go, and it's the one window of time that they try to compress. All right, just ask him one question and get out of there. You know, like, we're running low on time. So if I let go of that and they're counting down to commercial and they're thanking Jesus for 20 minutes, I can't go to commercial. Like, I've lost my ability to guide the show. And so I can't throw, you know, thank, you know, back to you, Sean, and then you can read the close and end the show or go to commercial, whatever you need to do. As soon as I let go of that mic, I can, you know, Robbie will be going, Jimmy, cut him off. And I'm going, I don't have the mic anymore. You know, I can't do that. It's like letting go of the wheel in a car.
But Jimmy, our first Bellator, so John, I don't know if you remember watching it, it was Bellator 13, and so I'd said, don't let go of the microphone. They throw you into the crowd. Who is there? Mickey Rourke and Jeremy Shockey. I don't want to say anything disparaging. It's a good thing that the USADA wasn't there testing that night.
Oh, they were blasted. I'm sitting in front of them, and back in those days, I mean, we're trying to figure out what we're doing, so it was like, okay, sit in front of him, ask a question. Okay, and in my ear, I hear 5, 4, 3, 2, and I got a blasted Mickey Rourke and a blasted Jeremy Shockey sitting next to me. And so I asked Mickey Rourke something. He says something. They both knew Roger Huerta, who was fighting that night. I go to Mickey Rourke, and I ask him a question. And I go to Jeremy Shockey, and I ask him a question, and he said something. And I start pulling the mic back, and he grabs it, and I grab it back. Back to you, Sean, because he was so wrecked. I was like, I didn't want to let him grab it and just start rambling or something. So that kind of started it, I think. But, you know, we have, you know, we're not a four-hour pay-per-view where you can go, hey, give them the mic and let them say whatever they want. Most of the time when I'm interviewing somebody, Robbie is going 15, 14, 13, 12. So I can't let go and have them talk for a long time. You know, somebody got, I guess, Mark Hunt. No, it wasn't somebody. It was Mark Munoz or something, I think. Retired, and they gave him the mic and let him say his piece in the microphone. Yeah, maybe somebody's retiring or something, but for a Fight Pass show or a pay-per-view, they don't have commercials. They can do whatever they want, and we can't. Like, our windows are really, really tight. So the people that wonder why I do that is because they're usually counting in my ear, and if I don't have that microphone, when he hits one, the show goes off the rails, you know? So you can't do that. So that's why that happens.
You've been with Bellator now for basically what? What's it going on now?
5 years?
I was going to say 6 years.
I think this is our sixth year.
This is our sixth year.
Six years. And, you know, you've seen a lot of changes. I know you had some times with Bjorn Rebney where there was even contract disputes and things like that. And you were thinking about leaving and then you ended up coming back. What is your opinion of the direction of the show now? What do you think Bellator needs to do better? What do you think that they're doing right, and where do you think things are going to end up being at?
The big question I have is the strategy that worked with Kimbo Ken and with Tito Bonner is big names my aunt knows who isn't into MMA will draw people in, and they'll see people like Michael Chandler and Daniel Strauss and Pitbull and tune in for the fighters that are more relevant to the sport. That is their strategy right now. So far, the numbers are working. The question is that handoff. When we get 2.5 million because Pitbull is headlining a fight, when we get 2.5 million because Michael Chandler is headlining a fight, when that football gets handed off, A, that's the direction we're trying to go to. That's the direction I want to go to. And that's the direction that I know once that transition happens, that's when the strategy has worked out. The double-edged sword is we've gotten big numbers with people who were not Bellator fighters, who made their name somewhere else. When we can do those numbers with Bellator talent, that's when the strategy has really, really taken off and really worked. And you know, that's where I look forward to it going, because the problem with, you know, like a big main event like the Ken Kimbo, every other fight on the card was fantastic. And Bellator fighters looked great, and that's not what people are talking about. When you're talking about them, when they're the big names, that's when that transition has been successful and worked. That's where we need to go.
Jimmy, I'll give you full credit. And John, I don't think you know this story, but when we moved over from M1 to Bellator, we have the seminar. It's the preseason seminar, and we're in Saratoga Springs, New York. Bjorn Rebney is laying out his vision of the tournament, and you pulled me aside and you said, "This is not going to work, man." You said, "There's a reason why they've been doing matchmaking in combat sports since the 1700s, because it works. This tournament is destined to fail."
There are two places, and John, please, or if you don't want to back me up, don't back me up. Dude. But if you agree with me, I really want to back up. There are two horrible places to be as a fighter. Number one is you still have a name, you don't have the skills to back it up. You are over the hill, but you put asses in seats, and the young lions want your pelt on their wall, but you're not as fast as you used to be, you're not as slick as you used to be, and you can take some serious beatings. I hate seeing a fighter go down that road, but we've all seen it. We all remember Sakuraba and Melvin Manoff and stuff like that, where legends are still legends, but don't have the skills to defend themselves from the young, hungry guys, okay? But they're fed to those guys. That's a horrible place to be as a fighter. Number two is a really good fighter, a really elite fighter that isn't crowd-pleasing. John Fitch in his prime, Jake Shields in his prime, Jason Black in his prime, remember him?
Jason Black's tougher
than Antonio McKee in his prime. The fans didn't respond to their style, but they can beat anybody in your organization. And promoters run from them like the fucking plague. Because, God forbid, that guy ends up being your champ, because they can do it. They can win. The problem with the tournament format is that guy, if you give him a spot in your tournament, he can win and he can beat anybody. That's what happened with Ben Askren. He won and kept winning, but had a style the fans didn't respond to. And Bjorn was going, fuck, what am I going
to
do now?
And Bjorn wanted Hornbuckle. It was supposed to be Hornbuckle.
It was supposed to be Hornbuckle. And Ben Askren kicked his ass for 15 minutes. I wrote a blog about it where I was talking about what I call crossroads fights, where you look at somebody's career and you go, man, after that fight, they were never the same dude.
Oh, who talks about that?
Dude, Dan Hornbuckle was never the same dude after he fought Ben Askren. He was never that same guy again. And dominance, just pure dominance. And the problem with the tournament format is the guy who wins isn't necessarily the guy the fans respond to, or the guys the fans want to see. And, you know, when it's a tournament and the best man wins, that's great. That philosophy is outstanding. And it worked when they didn't have a lot of money to put toward talent. But the problem is sometimes you get people winning when it's the wrong guy. When Pat Curran beats Roger Huerta, who you made a huge investment in, that's when the tournament goes off the rails. And so it was hard to use that system, and that's why it's gone.
And Art Davey, in the early days of the UFC, recognized that people wanted to see a rematch with Hoist Gracie and Ken Shamrock. So he immediately started to move at UFC 4 away from the tournaments. And to me, Bjorn Rebney, one of the downfalls of being our boss and being in charge of the company, Jimmy, he was so rigidly locked into that tournament format. Now, in September, we're going to do the one-night four-man light heavyweight tournament. That's cool.
Makes much more sense.
Pride had the Grand Prix. That's cool. But you and me would get on air and we would say, tonight we start a new season and we have 8 tournaments. And we also conclude these other tournaments that were wrecked by injury. So a total of 48 different tournaments. We're going to email you a pie chart so you can figure this out. I mean, it was homework to watch Bellator.
We had a champ. I think it was Zach McCoskey, if I remember correctly. We had a tournament at 135. Or 145. I forget what he was 135.
35.
Yeah, he was a 35er. And anyway, we had a tournament coming up. And so I'm announcing the guys are in the tournament. And I said, and they'll face the champ. And I blanked on the champion's name on live TV. And I just tap danced for a second. It came to me. And I think it was Zach McCoskey, I don't remember. And I said his name. And we're walking back to the desk. And I'm mad at myself. Oh, man, I fucked that up. And then I went, I haven't seen that dude fight in a year and a half. Of course I blanked on who the dude was. The tournament became the star, in a sense. And our champs would sit on the fence for a year. And I remember when Eddie Alvarez lost to Michael Chandler. Huge night for us. Hollywood, Florida. Great night of fights. We get this young, hungry lion winning to take the belt. And somebody from Spike, no, we weren't on Spike yet. Someone from Bellator ran up to me. And they said, oh, my God, isn't this amazing for us? And I said, what the fuck am I supposed to say? Tune in next season where maybe Eddie Alvarez enters a tournament, maybe he wins, and maybe he gets another shot at Michael Chandler. We could never strike when the iron was hot. The reload process was 6 fucking months. So it was like, tune in next season where Michael Chandler will fight the winner of another tournament. There's no heat behind. There's no nothing. Name recognition. There's no, man, fans want to see that. Too bad the rematch is going to take a year if he gets through all these fights. It didn't allow us to take advantage of lightning striking and going, man, this is hot. We couldn't do it. We had to just reload the format again. Bjorn's biggest weakness as a promoter, because he had plenty of them in other areas, but his biggest weakness as a promoter is he would really convince himself that a certain fight was going to work out a certain way to get him out of a problem he had created. And as a promoter, you got to go, this guy might win and this guy might win. What are my strategies for either guy? He would make a fight and swear to God, this guy's going to win by knockout. And I went, dude, you're out of your fucking mind. No, he's going to win. And I went, dude, you're betting your promotional life on, first off, an MMA fight, which never, ever do that. But he would really think, this is going to get me out of this problem I've created. And he would really convince himself. And you can't do that. You can't, as a promoter, put all your chips on one dude. And he would do that all the time and really convince himself that somebody was going to win a fight. And we would all go, you know, me and Manny and you and the people that are get paid to know fighting would go, bro, that is, I would put 70% odds against your guy winning. And we'd tell him that to his face, and he wouldn't listen, and it wouldn't work out. But he had that way of talking himself into that.
You know, but the whole thing, and this is, I can go back to the UFC where, same thing.
Yeah.
You know, there was times when they were riding the bus on one fighter, and you're going, he's limited. You don't do that. You're taking a chance. And I saw it with Bjorn, and, you know, it comes down to, I'm not saying this in a bad way, but you're working for people that don't know as much as you do.
It's promotional wishful thinking.
They want to put out that I know. Yeah. It's like, you don't understand fighting, dude. You haven't done it. And if you haven't done it and you don't understand the little differences of why this guy is going to end up possibly winning this fight by, he's got a 70% chance to a 30% chance, they don't get it because they get caught up in the hype like a fan. And as soon as you do that, you're dead.
Dude, I don't hold stock in Bellator. I will call the fight no matter who wins. I don't have that emotional investment that a promoter has, who's like, this guy wins, I make millions. This guy wins, you know, my kids don't go to college. I don't have that investment, you know, in emotionally. And no one can have that investment and think logically about the outcome of a fight. And, you know, so it's a very human failing to think, well, I've got this all writing, so it better work. MMA doesn't work that way, man. You know, life laughs at plans, and MMA is an extension of that completely. So that would happen, you know, and you and I witnessed it a lot where he's like, this guy's going to win. And you go, dude, if I were a betting man, I would not bet on your guy. And it wouldn't work out.
It's funny. It worked out 0% of the time.
Not a lot.
It worked out zero. And then the fighters that were brought in and were given a tune-up, like Rosie Sexton, who got knocked out by Zoila Frosto, yeah. It never worked out. Roger Huerta lost his second fight in Bellator.
Yeah. Yeah. it was that issue of, it isn't necessarily, you know, the guy you think is going to win doesn't win or this or that. It's you know, that I don't have to deal with this guy's contract because he's going to lose this fight. And I went, I would not bet on that. You know, like when you're making promotional decisions or you're making, you know, big decisions about what's about to happen based on this guy winning, and you're like, I would, in MMA, you can't ever do that. And, you know, I remember in Strikeforce, the same happened with Jake Shields and Dan Henderson. They promoted the hell out of Dan Henderson, and Jake Shields kicked his ass. And it's just, that's the nature of promoting. You got to hedge your bets and go, hey, look, Jake's a tough dude. You know, so I grappled against that guy. I know. Oh, so it's one of those things where you go,
Jake's a beast.
You have to hedge your bets. You have to know one guy, the other guy might win. Every promotion does it.
He's just not pretty in the way he does anything athletically. His stand-up is not pretty, but you know what? He's tough. He will throw his hands in, especially now. He'll go after you. And you look at a guy like Jake, his grappling is so heavy. The way he does it, and if you don't roll and you never rolled with him, you'll never know. Yeah. But that dude grabs your neck. He grabbed mine, and it's like, holy crap. I mean, he has got ways and angles, and the way he does things, you know, that whole group, you know, you've got, you know, the Diaz brothers, you got Gil Melendez, Jake Shields, now he's got Crone Gracie, you know, training with him all the time, Yancy Medeiros, all these guys, they're just evolving in the way they do things. And although Jake is an older fighter, you can never count that guy out of a fight because he can win it with a submission real fast because he's that good at it. Yeah. You know, all these guys, my question for you is, when you see the Bellator fighters, yeah, and then you see the, you know, fighters from other, you know, companies, you know, World Series of Fighting with someone like a Jake Shields or the UFC, how are you feeling when you're watching, because you're seeing, how do you think they stack up? And you know there's guys that are in Bellator that are as good as anybody in any promotion in the world, but they don't get the credit. How do you feel about that?
Okay. I don't know when I've thought about this, and I didn't know when I was ever going to say it, but I'm saying it now.
This is the show.
Okay, this is the show. I am right now, and one thing, John, you know me, I don't shill for anybody. I do my job, but I have a real hard time feeding people bullshit. I really do. And I, you know, and so it's been an issue in the past with my bosses, but I will tell you right now, in my honest opinion, the difference between the UFC and Bellator, and this is honestly what I think, it's honestly what I believe. If you don't agree with me, I understand, but this is what I think. I'm not shilling for anybody. On a good night, Will Brooks beats anybody in the UFC. I'm not saying he'd be the favorite. I'm saying a couple things would have to go his way against the top guys, but if the dominoes fell the right way, he could beat anybody in the UFC. The UFC has 10 guys that on a good night could beat Will Brooks. The way people generally compare promotions is, how does a top guy stack up against the top guy? Most top guys, if they got a couple breaks, could beat the top guy of the other promotion. The UFC has crazy depth. They have 15 dudes that are really fucking good. Yep. It isn't about the elite, and that's how people tend to do that. Oh, our champ would beat up your champ. Dude, Michael Chandler gets on a run, can beat anybody in the world. It's similar to what I found out when I was on Fight Quest, which before I went to a country to do Muay Thai, for example, before I went to Thailand, you hear all these rumors about how they train in Thailand. Oh, they fucking kick trees, they hit their shins with metal bars, and they fucking take this tiger blood and drink it. They do, and I heard all those things, I swear. They do what anybody in the U.S. does. You go to a gym and they train hard.
Hello.
But at a Muay Thai gym in the United States, a good one, a big one, three or four guys are trying to be pro. In Thailand, it's full of murderers. Half that gym fights at Lumpini Stadium every weekend. When I was down at Nova Union in Brazil, training with them, at my gym, which is Hey Diogo in L.A., three or four guys were getting ready for a big tournament like Pan Ams. Okay, three or four guys are really trying to make a run at Pan Ams. When I was down with Novan Yom, it was right before Worlds or something, and I said, who's going to Worlds? And the guy looked at me like I was crazy and went, we're all going to Worlds. I was like, it's 30 people in the room, and they're all getting ready for Worlds. That's the UFC strength. It's not the best in the U.S., let's say Jeff Glover, for example, does really well against the best from Brazil. The best, it's that in Brazil, there are 30 guys that have a good match against Jeff Glover. And that's what the UFC has. It's not their champs tower over everybody else's champs. It's they've got 10 or 15 dudes that on a good night can be the best in the world. It's their depth. And in Bellator, we have to work very hard as a promotion to get that recognition. Will Brooks has to go undefeated for 3 years and finish everybody he fights before people go, he might be a top five guy. If you string together three in a row in the UFC, you're the number one guy in the world. It's very easy for them to just reload that gun, and we have to put a lot of promotional energy to get a guy who can beat five guys in a row that we can put up there that you will think make him a top five guy. That's the difference, is not the elite versus the elite. It's the depth, those 10 guys.
Yeah, I think the one thing I think hopefully people learned off of the absorption of Strikeforce into the UFC is, you know, at the time, everyone dismissed Strikeforce about, oh, yeah, that was, you know, their guys are not as good. And, you know, depth-wise, you're absolutely right. Overall depth, the UFC was better. But look at the top guys in Strikeforce and look where they're at now in the UFC. And
light
look
up
at,
in the mix.
We got Luke Rockhold. He's fighting for the championship. You got Daniel Cormier. He's a light heavyweight champion. You got
Gilbert Melendez. Exactly. Yeah, heavyweight Verdum.
Hello.
Studs. It's the number one, and the same thing with WEC. I remember talking to a coach I will not out on this show, a notable, really good MMA coach. And I was asking, it was right when the UFC bought the WEC, or not bought it, but folded it into the UFC. And I said, how do you think the lightweights do from the WEC? And he turns to me and said, they all get smoked in the UFC. He literally said, I remember BJ Penn, I think, was champ then, and he was seen as, you know, a level above everybody else. They literally said, oh, the lightweights in WEC, they don't do anything in the UFC.
Wow.
Well, they're the elite of the UFC. Yeah. It's the number one guy in Strikeforce has done very well in the UFC. Who was the number five guy in Strikeforce? Scott Smith, Kung Lee, like guys that were, you know, good, worth watching, but their number five guys didn't do that well.
Yeah.
So the way people, I think, compare organizations, you know, Toquinho, dude, that dude will, if I'm Robbie Lawler, I went nowhere near a cage with Toquinho. Not that he loses, but you could, and he'll fold your leg the wrong way. It's a matter of not comparing the elite. It's, okay, once you get that past that elite one or two, how many guys you got? UFC has a ton of guys. That's their strength.
That's Jimmy Smith, my Bellator MMA broadcast partner, who spoke with John and me earlier this week. We're back with you next week for a new episode of Let's Get It On, first available on Friday. Download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. For Android, download the Stitcher app and subscribe. And you can go straight to our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. You can also find us on social media, facebook.com/letsgetitonpodcast, and on Twitter, @podcastMMA for this show, and for us personally, @JohnMcCarthyMMA and @SeanWheelock. To ask us a question, make a comment, or inquire about becoming a sponsor of Let's Get It On, email us at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Again, that's info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. And please help us spread the word. This is your podcast as much as it is ours. For John McCarthy, our producer Chris Lakin, and our entire crew, I'm Sean Wheelock. Thanks for listening, everyone. This has been a presentation of Ignotainment Media Network, online at ignotainment.com.
Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock, only on the Ignotainment Media Network. Don't forget to leave a rating and review in the comments section of the iTunes podcast store. If you have questions, comments, or are interested in sponsoring the show, contact us at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com or check out our additional lineup of podcasts, including Ocho Man, Behind the Eight Ball, The Whiskey Philosopher, and Youth Baseball Talk at ignotainment.com.